Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 446. Did I just say that? Oh my gosh, that's a lot of chatting going on of Her, the podcast where you're going to hear the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her aging, her own age wave. And I just can't tell you how excited I am to bring on board Dr. Ken Dykewald for this episode. Not only a dear friend of a lot of years, but, well, wait a minute, hold that thought before I get into his full bio and the rest of it. I just want to let everyone know that this terrific episode is made possible by our friends at Solaray Vitamins, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y Vitamins. This is top-level stuff. Oh, you know how it goes. We try to have our greens and the five colors every day. We wake up in the morning with great hopes, and the whole thing falls apart by 5 o'clock, and we haven't gotten anything done. So we got your back. Let's fill in some gaps with a multivitamin at the very least. So run on over to solaray.com to learn more. And here's your very first reminder to run on over to iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show, because we love your feedback. My whole team sits around just waiting to hear from you. It's just platinum to us. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Ken, welcome to the Her podcast again.
Great to be here. Always good to be in contact with you, my friend.
All right. So Ken is an American entrepreneur, gerontologist, psychologist, lecturer, and co-founder and chief executive officer of Age Wave. This is a California Bay Area based population aging, a business management company that has done an incredible job of basically sponsoring some of the most pivotal studies in aging in this country and globally. He is a global leader in gerontology, and Age Wave is the nation's foremost thought leader on issues relating to an aging population, with great expertise in the profound business, social, healthcare, financial, workforce, and cultural implications of all of this. Oh God, Ken, one of the best things that's ever happened to me was meeting you a heck of a long time ago and staying up with all of your brilliant research. Now you have a brand new book that has just come out. And this book is absolutely amazing. Radical Curiosity. Radical. Where did you get that title? Okay, how many editors were involved? There it is. Radical Curiosity. Okay, I mean, seriously, I'm just curious. Give me the genesis of that book title, because after having written a gazillion of these myself and working on one right now, it is a nightmare trying to come up with a decent title.
Well, I had imagined that the title of the book was going to be The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which was a character in Fantasia that I just personally identified with. And this book is a memoir. It's my 19th, and it's the only book that I've written sort of the inside story of my journey. My other books have been about the age wave or healthy aging or workforce crisis. But when my editor and publisher read the book, he says, "We're not going to call it Sorcerer's Apprentice." I said, "Well, yeah, we are." He says, "No, we're going to call the book What Drives You." And I said, "You're going to tell me what drives me?" And he says, "Yeah." And I says, "What is it?" And he said, "Curiosity. Throughout your whole life, curiosity keeps pulling you forward." And I related to it. I liked it. And I decided to amp it up a little bit, calling it Radical Curiosity, because I said to him, "Well, everybody's curious." And he said, "No, they're not. You know, a lot of people want to know what time's dinner and what's on TV tonight, but trying to figure out, you know, the meaning of things and the lessons we learn in our lives and what's the relation between the mind and body and how do we age well, I've been driven by these fascinations for decades. I got involved in the field of gerontology when I was 24, and I've just recently turned 73. So I've been in the field for 49 years, and the field is getting hot now, as you know, but you and I and others have been digging around in it for a long time.
Yeah, I know. And it's not only hot, it's burning hot. It's blazing. I mean, we've got ourselves a full-on fire here. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so interested. Look, you and I are both doing it. We're aging. Well, we're all aging. But what's happening is that you are driven, obviously, with a real personal passion and feeling of meaning and purposefulness about this whole sector. But also, you're driven by metrics. Tell us about the study.
My company, as you mentioned, is called AgeWave, and all of the studies we do are available for free. So if anybody just wants to go to the agewave.com website, you can get all these different studies. We might mention one or two in this session, but they're all available for free for those of you who are curious about what we've learned. But you mentioned this new one. We did a study that we called, kind of whimsically, the new age of aging. Why do we call it that? Well, I took note when Betty White passed away, because the amount of media attention she got was unbelievable. And people said, wait a minute. I always thought of 99-year-olds as kind of decrepit, frail, fragile. This gal was beautiful. She was funny. She had great timing. She was full of life. She cared about animals. She cared about people. She cared about her future. And she was 99. And then there's Helen Mirren eating up the airwaves at 78. And there's Martha Stewart on the cover of Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue at 81. And all of a sudden, everywhere we look, there's a different version of aging popping up. So we thought we would dig around in there and try to find out, like, what's going on and what are some of the, where are the arrows pointing? Couple of the key insights. We asked people, at what age did your grandparents turn old? 60. They were clear as a bell about that. My grandparents were old people when they were 60. And when do people turn old now? They were clear about that. 80 or later, right? So they see the Rolling Stones dropping their first album in 18 years, and there's Smokey Robinson at 83 putting his first new album out. And as I mentioned, these women are becoming increasingly powerful. Nancy Pelosi is getting set to run for office again. And people are starting to realize that old is moving. It's relocating. And sometimes people say to me, 80 is the new 60. I kind of think 80 is the new 80. I don't, you know, being 60 again means that everything, let's say you're 70, everything that's happened in the last decade, you have to give up. And why would you want to do that? Then we ask people, when was the best time in your life? And we ask people over the age of 65. 71% say either now or it's still in front of me. Now, that's pretty wild, because it used to be that we had this notion of being over the hill, that you reach 50 or 60 and the best time of your life was behind you. What else? We ask people, would you like to be youthful or useful? 4-1, useful. Yeah, being youthful is great. And I look at you and I see you're a triathlete still, and you've got every graduate degree there could possibly be. You've got 3 New York Times bestsellers. But here you are still working away and trying to change the world, make an impact. And you're not alone. There's a whole generation of people in their 50s and 60s and 70s who want that kind of life. And the idea of retirement is being kind of the wind down. What we saw in our study was people are saying, no, this is a whole new chapter in life. In fact, I'd like some coaching. I'd like some courses. I'd like some discussion about how do you reinvent yourself at 55 or 65? How do you find a new purpose? How do you go back to school? How do you fall in love again? Or how do you train for your first triathlon when you're 70 years old? And, you know, that's a lot of what you've been seeing, Pam, over the decades. And it's mounting. I would also tell you that the 65 and over group is going to grow by 53% over the next 20 years. And so we normally think of growth as being more young people, more kids, and they're going to buy more young people stuff. Turns out that people over 50 control about 70% of all the wealth in America and the modern world, and they are now the most dynamic consumers. And frankly, they, and I'll put myself in this category, although I'm not a her, I am a he, we're kind of sick of being made fun of in advertising. We're kind of sick of being left out of Valentine's ads. We're kind of sick of being thought of as unimportant. And I think that you're going to see a more demanding, more powerful, and more outrageous version of aging. People say grow old gracefully. I think people want to grow old outrageously. And, you know, with adventure, with spirit, with purpose. And I think that's what's coming.
I think it's happening because I hang out and you hang out with a lot of kindred spirits along this line. And what I'm hearing is from women, you just love this. You can just quote this way. Women want to, and I quote, kick ass. They want to keep kicking ass. And I keep hearing that phrase going, you know, are you guys talking to each other or what up? And instead, they said, you know, don't you dare stereotype me. I am who I am. I feel powerful. I feel like I'm living a life where I'm leveraging years of experience, wisdom, and knowledge. And I'm mentoring, I'm teaching, I'm sharing, and all of that is going on. I mean, you look at Warren Buffett. I mean, how old is he? Hello, you know, and you just keep it rocking. We also have science and the National Institute of Aging, and you're obviously one of their big experts, has clearly conducted some great studies showing that if you, and I quote, retire, when you retire and you just kick back and do almost nothing all day, your mortality rate leaps, your morbidity rate leaps, and suddenly you have no way to be able to really think about purpose and meaning the way you used to, because you externalized it. Well, I was the vice president of blah, blah corporation, and that was your purpose and meaning. Well, you know, surprise, surprise, things have changed up a little bit here. And when you say I'm still, and I quote, working, I can honestly say, even though some pretty heinous years of training and all the rest of it, that I've never worked a day in my life because I love everything I do. There are funky times and whatever, but I leverage it out. I kind of balance that out saying, yeah, but you know, the good stuff is so much better. So, you know, look, you do hard things, you work it, and that's the price you pay.
I want to emphasize, though, that this is a new frontier for our parents and their parents. You reach 60 or 65, and you pretty well thought it was time to get out of the way and enjoy a couple of years of relaxing and taking a vacation before your batteries wore out. Kind of things you're saying. And you were born in the 1950s, as was I. These are new ideas. You know, throughout 99% of human history, the average life expectancy worldwide was under 18. I know that sounds insane, but there were always 40 or 60 or 80-year-olds, but most people died very young. So we were a world of young people. Now we're becoming a world of older adults, and we're having to try to figure out, how much work do I want to do? Do I want to do the same thing? Do I want to try something new? You know, I met you maybe 25 years ago. If I would have said to you, hey, in 25 years, we'll be doing a podcast together, you would have said, what's a podcast? And, you know, I'm a doctor. Here we are trying all sorts of new things. And what we also see is that people want some more balance. You know, you and I are both kind of workaholics. During COVID, I did 3 books, 2 PBS specials, and 250 keynotes. And I'm still unwinding from that. Most people say they'd like to work maybe half time and have more time to play and more time to socialize and more time just to relax. And maybe that's a good lesson too. And I've given talks to college kids and they cheer when they hear that because they don't want to work like nuts for 40 years and then have leisure for the next 25. They want a blended life. And I think that's particularly meaningful for women. And I realize that I don't want to get into mansplaining here, but I do have a kick-ass wife, and she lectures me pretty steadily about all these topics. She's also an expert on these things. And women live about 5 to 6 years longer than men. So a life for a man is one thing. A life for a woman is a longer thing. And the generation that you're a part of, Pam, was the most educated, empowered generation of women in the history of planet Earth. So here you've got a lot of women that went to college, decide they wanted to be a secretary necessarily or a school teacher necessarily. They might have, but they decided, no, I want to be what I want to be. And now at 50 or 60 or 70, I read a quote from Oprah recently. She's 69. Ain't nobody's going to tell me I'm too old for anything. I'm just coming into my power. I've learned so much. I've got more resilience. I've got a little bit of wisdom. I'm not looking to be pushed to the sidelines. And I think in the years to come, older women are going to be the power base in the world, both because of longevity and extra knowledge and resilience.
I'm sort of seeing that a bit globally. You're seeing more and more leadership in Europe and other places where women have a greater representation, needless to say. And I'm just looking up the Nobel Prize Economics.
Yeah, as a woman just won it.
Yeah. And okay, so it's Claudia Golden. She's at Harvard, and I've been following her work for quite some time. It was just announced like 24 hours ago or whatever. She has incredible statistics. I'm actually going to have her on my show as soon as she gets over the 900 parties that are taking place up in Boston. I mean, Harvard, like, can't get over itself with yet another Nobel laureate. But she collected some amazing work, a breadth of knowledge and research with no equal, where she was able to show the inequity, inequality, when it related to women's pay, when it related to women's ability to have the opportunity to engage. She had a fabulous study that was published in 2000. And in this study, what she did was there were symphonies that were hiring musicians. And, you know, it's like a big thing to be hired as like first or second violin at Chicago Symphony or whatever. What she found was that when they conducted blind auditions, so you didn't know if it was a man or a woman playing that musical instrument, that when they did that, the representation of women who were then hired as musicians all but doubled. Because when they saw that it was a woman playing, there was bias, whether people were even aware of it one way or the other. She has so much great research. I applauded, you know, the Nobel Committee for really calling her out on all of this to congratulate her on this incredible work. So to your point, she's 77 years old, and she's still full professor at Harvard, still kicking ass and still doing, you know, meaningful, purposeful work, and also inspiring and mentoring legions of other scientists, many of whom are women, because she laid down the path. And she was the first tenured professor in economics at Harvard. So she really kind of worked it through the system. And I say all this because, to your point, yeah, women in their 70s and whatever have really made a huge difference. There's no question about it.
But I'm going to add, if I might, Pam.
Oh, please.
You say we're there, and I would say it's just starting. There's two things going on. One is you're seeing a lot of older men who are not particularly attractive role models. I know your show is Her, but I want to say, as a guy who's 73, I look around at some of these people running for office or trying to lead the world, and I think to myself, yikes, I don't want to be like them.
What is it that bothers you about them? Because that helps inform us about women, too.
I think that men, I hate to say this because I don't want to go political on you, but there was a day when Rudy Giuliani, who at one point in his life was a powerful guy, was out in front of what he thought was the Four Seasons, but it was a porn stop, and he had his hair dye leaking down his face, and he was lying about all sorts of things. And I thought, wow, I think we've just seen the downfall of the male species. There's a lot of older men that don't quite know what they're doing. They don't quite know what their role is, or if they've dealing with transitions is required in a longevous era. And women, I've been a mom, I've been a caregiver, I've been a wife, I've been a daughter, I've been a friend, I've been a boss, I've been looking for a job, I've been all sorts of things. And guys often are very geometric in their identity. I'm the vice president of something. And when they grow older, they kind of have a hard time making transitions. Or if they get sick, who am I now? Or if their wife falls out of love with them, they don't know how to kind of pick themselves up and become a human being again. And I think that women, their fluidity, their longevity, their smarts, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on your show, I think that we're going to see more and more in the years to come. You and I, maybe 25 years from now, are going to do another show, and we're going to say, see, look at these changes that have happened. But the biases are real. We've come out of 100,000 years where women were the domestic managers and guys were the hunters and gatherers. That's all in the process of changing, partly driven by increasing longevity.
Yep, and there's no question about that. It's interesting. It seems as though young men, well, a lot of young men are not engaging in things like college and graduate school and back and forth. Now it's young women who really are more greatly represented on college campuses. You know, medical schools, a huge number of them now, the majority of the students are women. So that's going to be a huge shift in the power structure in medicine alone.
Yeah, for every 100 guys that graduate college this last decade, there were 132 girls. And the number one most common living arrangement for young adult men, 18 to 34 years old, is living at home with their parents. And so what we're seeing is not just boomer generation or X generation, but these young girls, young women are powerhouses. And so as we move towards the future, I think we're going to see increasingly the power of women stand up tall.
Well, you know, I think this is going to also be reflected in relationships. What are relationships? How is Gen Z looking at a relationship versus a boomer versus Gen X or the millennials? It's really interesting. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert, but I think the generations are shifting big time in how they define each other's role. To a certain degree, there are some ups and some downs. You know, when you swipe left all day long, what does that do to a relationship? You know, I met my husband in a gym. Obviously, I'm an athlete. He is too. So wipe the shock off your face. But that, to me, that was old school. It's like I actually saw him, you know, eye to eye, and we lifted weights together and things like this. I didn't swipe anywhere. I mean, it's also interesting to see, you know, this shift. How do you define all of these roles now? You say that women are going to be more powerful. What does that do to the structure of, as it were, and definition of a family?
Well, we got a lot of our notions of family watching television in the 1950s and watching Disney movies. And there's this sort of romantic notion of heterosexual, two people joining, deciding that they're going to fight the world together. The men are going to do this, the women are going to do that. But now, young people, they don't necessarily subscribe to that model. You know, they grew up with friends where a group of people live together. They're more sexually fluid. They don't necessarily feel they've got to be a mom in order to live a good life. So there are some new challenges and there's some new sociologies emerging. But the younger generations, rather than putting them down, my kids are 33 and 36, rather than putting them down for how they go on the apps and on social media for their networks, that's the future. I mean, that's a lot of the way they grew up. You know, they're digital natives. We're digital immigrants. And I think we can learn from them and they can learn from us. I personally am glad that I fell in love and got married and did it the old-fashioned way. And worry about the younger generations missing out on that, but who am I to say?
Exactly. You and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I absolutely absolutely love your new book, Radical Curiosity, because, you know, I'm seeing so much of humanity in you. I now see the depth of your upbringing, the impact, and all the rest of it. And I think you and I did some interesting stuff along the way. I never anticipated ever, nor did I ever have an expectation of working for someone for 40 years and getting a gold watch and then, you know, doing some retirement play. It just never occurred to me, you know, it could be 3 degrees from Berkeley made me this way because I'm just so open-minded about things. But no matter where I went professionally, whether I had to give a talk in Vancouver or whatever, I always set aside time for play, fun, discovery, and some way to enhance myself. I would look ahead to museums. I would look ahead to parks where I can hike, run, do my thing. I would look up friends. And I don't care if the meeting was, you know, in and out in, you know, 48 hours. I didn't do that. I added a day or two so I could blend an enjoyment of something amazing because I saw so many people put this aside and procrastinate and just say, no, you know, I'll wait until. Well, part of the issue is I'm a doctor. I know too much. I know what happens. By the age of 50, I don't care what kind of shape you're in, the probability of little, you know, funky things happening increases. And so why are you waiting? You know, you should live all the way through. And I see this with Gen Z, with the millennials. They're really adding a lot more in there as they live, which brings me to another point. You know, the word retirement, I'm going to just say, I don't like the word. I have no idea what it means. What I see is reinvention, transitions. That's what would make more sense to me. If you tell me I'm going to live until I'm 90 or, you know, whatever, I want to be transitioning. To your point before, I want to learn more. I want to challenge myself. I want to grow. I want to stop. You know, I never want to stop growing one way or the other. So why would I, and I quote, retire? I think that's an old capitalist term, and you see it globally. You saw the fiasco in France with that whole, you know, retirement thing, at what age and everything. I don't like that word. I like transitions and reinventions. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I've written a number of books on retirement, so I've done a little homework on the history of retirement. And let me point out, before around the 1930s, there basically was no retirement. If you were too old to work in the field, you took a different job. And there were three reasons why people kept working. Number one, you earned some money. Number two, you had a purpose, a reason to get up in the morning. And number three, you socialized, you interacted. Did you go to church this weekend? How are your grandkids? Let me tell you what's going on in my life. What a lot of people don't realize is that Roosevelt was quite brilliant. There was a problem in the 1930s that the elderly had a very high poverty level. And he thought that if they got a stipend, it was $10 a month, $120 a year, Social Security, that's what the price was back then that might save them from going to the poorhouse. But just as important was the fact that the unemployment levels had reached 25%. So he thought if we can get the old people out of the workforce by institutionalizing the end of work, we can make room for the young. Now, we don't have that problem currently. We've got a unemployment challenge taking place. I would tell you, Pam, and this is not to be contrarian, but when you and I were growing up, there were three major flavors of ice cream, vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. And if you went to a fancy restaurant, there was Neapolitan, which is like a mashup of all of them. Now there's probably 500 ice cream choices you can make. I think there's lots of choices. Some people may want to retire. Makes them feel good. They worked hard. They feel like now it's my time to sit back and watch TV or to take walks and do what I feel like doing. Other people might want to train for a marathon. Other people may want to mentor young people. Other people may want to go on dating sites. Other people may want to, your listeners and viewers, there's every flavor out there. And I don't want to say, I'm not keen on retirement. I think it casts people to the side. I think that there's a lot of people that feel a kind of a worthlessness when they get older and they try to keep themselves busy but it's busyness without purpose, without meaning, without heart. And so I'd like to see a world where we were more engaged in different generations. I'll give you an example. I was giving a talk right before COVID started, and the other speaker was Harrison Ford. And I had never met him, and he talked about, you know, he's a climate activist, and he talked about how he got to get at all the young people of the world planting trees, and he got a standing ovation. And I had a private meeting with him afterward, and first I fawned over him, you know, hey, you've done some cool roles. It's nice to meet you. But are you aware of the fact that there's a billion people over 60 on the planet right now, and nobody has tasked them with anything? Why don't you get them planting a few trees? And he looked at me and he said, I never thought of that. Most people don't think of that. They don't think of trying to find a 65 or 70-year-old. And I'll add one other piece to the puzzle. Partly what got me to write Radical Curiosity, and by the way, I didn't do it for the money. I'm donating all of my earnings to the Esalen Institute. My last three books, I'm donating all the earnings to various not-for-profits, which is a little bit my way of volunteering, you know, working pro bono. But if you're going out on a hike or a camping trip, Pam, and there were some people returning from a camping trip, it might be a good idea to ask them, are there rattlesnakes out there somewhere? And where's the beautiful sunset to be seen? And is there any fresh water to be found? And are there any good places to sleep? Now, you don't have to take any of their advice, but life lessons are something that people who've lived 60 or 70 or 90 years have got a lot of. And to not take advantage of the wisdom and the experience of older adults is just plain silly. It's not taking advantage of this new frontier of longevity that we're seeing, where people still have got their wits about them and they've got a lot of experiences to share and lessons. I mean, imagine if somebody sat down with you and said, tell me the 100 things you've learned in your life about health or wellness or business or being a powerful woman. You could fill up that 100 idea list. And that idea of legacy, of what are the lessons you've learned. And another thing that drove me to write the book was people like you and I, when you write books, your listeners may not realize this, but you get out on the lecture circuit and you meet other people who are on the lecture circuit. So I've had, you know, I got trained in feminism by Betty Friedan, and Nelson Mandela shared with me what he thought leadership was. And Jimmy Carter asked me to work with him on his book about aging and death. And, you know, I've met and learned from some of the world's great thinkers and philosophers. Joseph Campbell taught me about the importance of the story and how to be a good storyteller. And, you know, Bucky Fuller taught me about having a purpose in life. And I try to share some of those lessons along with my own personal lessons in the book. And as we grow older, we shouldn't be measured by the metric of youth. We should be measured by a new metric, the metric of longevity, where we probably have more stories to tell and more lessons we've learned.
I absolutely applaud that. There's no question about it. And, you know, I know so much, you know, I know too much about the science of sitting on your ass with no purpose and meaning and feeling lost and alone. That's it. Again, it has a huge impact on the rate of death and the rate of disability, medically and otherwise. So I don't like that. I love this whole issue of 1 billion people over the age of 60. And what are we doing to be able to create opportunities for them to continue to engage, to continue to explore where they're going to find meaning and purpose in life? That's absolutely has to be a huge priority globally.
But nobody is stepping up to liberate that, to leverage that. And I want to add one other thing that if I got off this program and didn't make a point about it, we in the United States do a pretty crummy job of matching our health spans to our lifespans. Lifespan is how long we live. By the way, we're 40th in the world. There are 39 countries in this world that live longer than we do, which is not something we ought to be proud of. But our health span, number of years that we spend free of illness or disability, we're ranked 60th in the world. We have 12 years of decline before the end of our lives. What most people would really like is to live well and to live with their health spans and their brain spans, making it to the end of their lifespans. And we have done a really mediocre job of causing that to happen. And how come this is not being asked of the people running for president? How come this is not number one question? Because it's costing a fortune. The fortune is crushing the finances of young people. It's crushing the lives of older people. It's creating enormous amounts of suffering. We need a new model of healthcare that produces health.
There's no question about it. You know, I just saw the other day a documentary series on the Blue Zone.
I finished watching it last night.
Yeah, and Buchner did it again. A lot of this, for all of us who've been following the Blue Zone work, and I'll explain, is no shocking surprise, but there were a couple things in there that I took away that I didn't appreciate from his other work. And so the Blue Zone's basically really characterized a half a dozen places around the world where you have clusters of centenarians. And not only do you have centenarians, I mean, they're thriving. They're just rocking it at 100, 105. And you're saying to yourself, well, wait a minute. So you've got Sardinia, Icaria, you've got Okinawa, Loma Linda, Costa Rica. I happen to, in this series, you might remember when they did Costa Rica, they showed a picture of Panchita, who was one of the most famous people in his book, The Blue Zones, from years ago. And I had the honor of meeting her in Nicoya a while back. And I was literally the first physician ever to visit her little kind of home. It was ironically in an area outside of Nicoya called Mansión, meaning mansion, which was the last thing these were. These were just beautiful, modest abodes with their own little gardens and chickens and, you know, whatever back and forth. What I recall from all of this in terms of longevity is they all have purpose in life. They define their own. In Okinawa, I mean, they're out of bed, boom, all right? And they're doing something. Gardening is a monster. They're just all over the gardens. They pick their own. They grow their own. They work hard in the kitchen. And, you know, if you don't cook, then you don't understand how much of your body is used in cooking when you're rolling and pushing and pulling and all the rest of it. So all of this really spoke to the issue of, gee, it's no surprise these people lived so long because they not only had all of that, but to your point, they had social connection. So if you're no longer at work and high-fiving, you know, your coworker or whomever and back and forth, well, what are you doing here for social connection? And with all the cultural changes happening, even in Japan, the young people don't want to have babies anymore, and they're really not taking care of their parents the way the culture used to and all the rest of it. What I loved in that was the Okinawan women, who far outlive the men, just formed their own little networks. They were called like morais or something started with an M. I loved it. And they were just sort of like, okay. And they were intergenerational. So you had like 65-year-olds hanging out with 80-year-olds who were hanging out with somebody who's pushing 90. And they all cared about one another. And they gave themselves meaning and purpose by doing that. And there was joy and all the rest of it. So meaning and purpose doesn't mean you have to start a company when you're 60. It just means you define it. But you got to find it. Because every single society had a name, a phrase for meaning and purpose. If you remember Ishigai or
Ikigai.
There it is.
In Okinawa.
In Okinawa. What is it? We need to be able to take those billion people over the age of 60 and help them discover meaning and purpose within their own communities so that they can have an optimized health span. Because you know when you live with meaning and purpose, you are going to have higher levels of health and well-being all the way around. Agree?
I do agree. And I would also say that it ought to work its way up, not just in the community, it ought to be systematized. When they showed Singapore, they gave examples of how the government made it easier for people to live near their family or made it easier to work out by having athletic parks in every community. We don't create a society to create healthy, long-lived people. we create a society that's go, 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 that creates a lot of high blood pressure, that creates a lot of diabetes, that creates a lot of vascular disease. Who am I telling? I'm telling the person that is fully knowledgeable about all these things. So watching that Living to 100 and the Buettner theme, and again, he's not a doc or a PhD gerontologist or psychologist. He's a guy that's just trying to figure it out and have us all stop and think a little bit. And good for him. I applaud him for that.
And it's visual. You could listen to these people, watch them. The series is really worth watching. And it's short. I think they're like 4 or 5 episodes. And they're easy to watch, easy on the eye. And man, are you going to learn. The one thing I to end that part is to many of these societies went through a lot of hardship. I mean, come on, Japan. Really? You know, World War II and, you know, just the whole thing. Sardinia, everyone and his brother was trying to take over this poor little area. And so no wonder they had to build a place way up above where nobody was going to be able to conquer them. Just so many, you know, cultures wanted in on this. So these people over time built a self-sustainable resilience that I think is reflected in their current living. And has really benefited them over time. It's a mental, spiritual, physical resilience that I think, you know, really helped them with their self-sufficiency. And it made them appreciate every single day they woke up and someone wasn't trying to conquer them. I took that away and I said, wow, there's another huge life lesson there. And that is, life is not some kind of easy street here.
Not a cakewalk.
It's not a cakewalk, but how are you going to make that all work for you? So as we're concluding all this, I mean, gosh, you know, Ken, you and I, we can talk forever. So I'm going to definitely have you back on to continue this because there are so many things happening in society today that keep resurrecting these same ideas and challenges and provocative and compelling research, so much of it coming from your AgeWave Institute. When I read Radical Curiosity, I got to say, I couldn't put it down because it made me reflect. I went down my own memory lane right along with you. You made me remember a lot of things and you excerpted so much knowledge and thoughts about how do you take this forward? How do you continue to live a life of meaning and purpose? How do you keep stoking radical curiosity until the very end? How do you keep pivoting? How do you adapt and adjust to all of life's changes? Because, honey, aging is not for the faint of heart in many respects. You know, when you wake up in the morning, you have to do that anatomical, you know, list, like, you know, does everything still work? And if it doesn't, are you working around that? I go back to, you know, one of my icons, which is Georgia O'Keeffe, when her eyesight started going and here she was, you know, 90-ish and whatever. She lived almost to 100. What did she do? She didn't sit there and whine like, oh, my eyesight's going. I can't do those iris pictures anymore and paintings and stuff. No, she said, okay, well, the eyesight's kind of like not the world's greatest, but my hands work and I can touch. And she started sculpting. And when I visited her home, I was blown away by the beauty that she created when she could barely see. And what did that say? She adapted and adjusted. She pivoted. She, you know, was resilient. And there was no huge complaining here. Are we teaching people that today?
No, we don't. And unfortunately, you got a lot of pop culture gurus who tell people that all you got to do is envision something and it all works out. And then people feel brittle and broken when it doesn't. And just as you're saying, Pam, I've known you a long time. You are a clinician and a medical expert, but you become a bit of a philosopher, which I appreciate being witness to. And there is something about adaptability and resilience that comes with a longer life that we ought to do a better job. You know, for example, we ought to have elders come into the schoolroom and teach young people about aging, about what it's like to lose something, about what it's like to be disappointed, about what it's like to pick yourself back up again and go for it. Those would be good lessons for people to be more familiar with and more aware of. Interestingly, in my book, people were more taken when you, you know, when you put out a memoir, it's weird because when you write a book about a subject, people can decide whether they agree with you or not. But when you write a book that's personal, people can decide whether they like you or not, which is hard. But people were more taken by the stories of trials and tribulations and struggles that I had than they were by my successes. And I've had a lot of both. So I think we could do a better job of letting people know how in the real world, you know, you get knocked around sometimes. And there's all kinds of ways to transition, as you say.
We got to teach them. It's just like, you know, we try to teach them, not very successfully, I suppose, you know, fiscal responsibility, you know, and there are so many layers of responsibility. What are we doing about, you know, laying down a strong foundation in health and wellness as well? So you can learn a heck of a lot more about this by actually running on over to agewave.com, where you'll learn about Radical Curiosity, My Life on the Age Wave, which is written by Ken Dykewald. Absolutely fabulous read. You won't be able to put it down just the way I had it. Oh, it was extraordinary. This was a huge accomplishment. And thank you for sharing your life with everyone. So, Ken, thank you once again for being on the Her Podcast.
And thank you for doing all the great things you've done for so long. And seems to me continue to do even better and smarter and stronger. So thank you for allowing me to be on this program.
Okay, everyone, run on over to iTunes right now, rate and review the show, because this was amazing, absolutely amazing. And another shout out to SolarAid.com, wonderful multivites for everyone. Just want to make certain that you know we got your back, SolarAid.com. Listen, I am just thrilled that Ken was on the show once again. I just sit here, take little notes all the time and learn so much from him every single time I see him. Listen, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek, Twitter and Instagram at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on everything, iTunes, Radio MD, Spotify, iHeart, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's over there. Just find it and listen. Thanks for being here to listen. Take care. Bye-bye.